Shabbat shalom. When Eddie offered me the Devar this week, she said, it's Machetz, it's Rosh Chodesh, it's Hanukkah, and it's the anniversary of the downstairs minyan. In the secular world, when that many things come together, we call that a perfect storm. But we're here in Shabbat, so I'm going to call it a perfect calm. We're right in the middle of a perfect calm. Machatz means at the end, and so everything should be calmed down. Instead, in this parsha, we find Joseph in a life that's been characterized by rises and falls, being upended in the most profound way possible. Just as sometimes happens to all of us. At Thanksgiving, my brother turned to me and said, what is that Yiddish saying? And I immediately said, man plans and God laughs. Because that is the basic Yiddish saying. The Dharma wheel turns. Previously, Joseph had been falsely accused of rape and sent to prison, where he interpreted the dreams of the chief baker and the cupbearer. He was correct in his interpretations. The baker was impaled, and the cupbearer was restored. Our parsha opens with the news that now Pharaoh has had a disturbing dream, and he doesn't like the official interpretation. He's looking for someone else to interpret them, and the cupbearer remembers Joseph. He refers to Joseph as, quote, a lad, a Hebrew, and a slave, which Rashi says are not very thinly veiled insults. Basically, he's saying he's some servant kid who barely speaks the language, a gutter snipe, a nothing, an undocumented worker. But Pharaoh is desperate, as we sometimes are when a dream haunts us. We may differ in our interpretations, but we all feel the dream's enigmatic power. In Judaism, the mind is a spiritual tool of the highest order. Everything it produces is worth examination, even the seemingly irrational mind of dreams. During the day, we have at least the illusion that we are directing our thoughts, but at night, in dream time, they go flying out of our control. I read Torah from my niece's bat mitzvah a few years back, and I was so nervous about getting it right that the whole week I had anxiety dreams. And in the one on Friday night, I dreamt I was called up to the bima, and then when I got there, they opened the Torah, and it was the yellow pages. Perhaps a child's wish for something that contains everything. We call this the conscious and the subconscious. In previous eras, it might have been known as our will and our fate. In Joseph's family drama, in this parsha, in December, full of short, dark days, where weather isolates us, we have nights of candlelight, mystery, miracles, and threats of annihilation, while next door, our Christian neighbors are celebrating a birth that does not historically bode well for us, you could forgive us for feeling confronted by sensations of helplessness and questions about who will help. So Joseph is called out of prison, and he interprets Pharaoh's dream of fat cows and skinny cows and fat grains and emaciated grains to mean there will be a famine in Egypt, 7 years of plenty, 7 years of drought. He is not passive in the face of foreseeable disaster. The plan is not to pray to God and hope to survive, but to deal with the difficulty. Fate in the form of a weather pattern that cannot be controlled, in the Torah asks for a response of our will. We're not meant to just lie down and take it, but make a plan and a choice and a decision. And Joseph has a good plan, which is to stockpile food against the coming famine. And he says that Pharaoh should, quote, seek out an understanding and wise man to oversee that process. We assume Joseph's humility here. He's not thinking that man should be himself. He's not Richard III. He's not a manipulator. But nevertheless, Pharaoh does appoint him over the whole land. He berings him. He exalts him. He gives him a wife and children. He lands him in a very powerful position, second in command to Pharaoh. And he has even more power soon because his prediction comes true. The famine is spread over the face of the land. Rashi says, who is the face of the land? It's the rich. It's so bad, this famine, even the rich people can't jump in their jets and go eat at the buffets in Dubai. So all the world has to come to Joseph in Egypt to get their food, and this, of course, includes his brothers, who tossed him into a pit to die. His brothers minus Joseph arrived to buy grain. Jacob sent them. He had to, or they'd starve. Joseph recognizes them, of course. He accuses them of being spies, so they'll come back with Benjamin. It's a kind of sad, twisted family reunion. And this is what propels the most perplexing part of the story, right? Joseph could just reveal himself and say, look, I'm the one you sold, and I forgive you, or I'm the one you left for dead, and I hate you. Of course, there would be no story. I think the last time I parsed this text, I brought in rabbinic ideas about the nature of forgiveness, how it can be far from linear, and perhaps that's the reason for Joseph's peculiar behavior. One of the great gifts of Eastern religions, and Judaism in particular, means that I don't have to remain attached to that answer. It's the basis of our famed intellectualism. I'm not meant to adopt a catechism. Other thinkers, non-Jewish thinkers, often dismiss Jewish methodology as tedious and nitpicky. The rabbis were hair splitters, mumbling over dead sources. When I was thinking about Arminian, I came across a Talmudic discussion about whether people who are drunk or asleep can be counted in Arminian. I've been both. Just kidding, I've never been asleep. The consensus was that sleepers are okay because you can wake them up, and it's all right if you're drunk, as long as you're not drunker than Lot. But don't use a brand new bridegroom, because he is so stunned by what happened to him last night, he's of no use at all. We must wake up, we must sober up, and temporarily stop thinking about sex. Why? So that once a week, the workings of mankind might be elevated to match the workings of their maker. So we reread the old passages in the same sentences, and we use our minds to make them new. With help, with love, with the downstairs minion. Still, the problem persists. What on earth is the point of this convoluted story that seems to devolve into, I'm sorry to say, a road comedy? We've left Richard III, and now we're in Measure for Measure. It's so theatrical. There's stolen cups and planted evidence, and there's camels racing across Egypt. And when two sons swear on their children's lives they won't endanger their younger brother, we know. We know by the rules of theater that it has to come to pass. And Joseph is a star. He's never been more successful. We think of failure as spiritually dangerous, but success also has its pitfalls. Because in both cases, we rub up against a simple matter that constitutes a great temptation, which is to ask, since we can't really control what happens to us, why would our actions matter at all? We rub up against a comforting nihilism. And who better to represent this than Joseph, the man to whom things just seem to happen? He's triumphant. His brothers are completely under his thumb. He can send them home. He can bring them back. He can mess with their minds. He can read their minds. He is this close to being an earthly divinity. In fact, he is second in command because he lives in a world in which, because it's Tuesday at 7, the baker is impaled and the cupbearer lives. But if it happened to be Saturday at 11, the cupbearer might have died and the baker be alive. It's all a whim, including this sudden appearance of his greatest triumph. And what does he do? I refer to the text. And they said to one another, indeed, we are guilty for a brother that we witnessed the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. This is why the troubles have come on us. The brothers are talking. And Reuben answered them saying, didn't I tell you, saying, do not sin against the lad? But you did not listen. Behold, his blood is being demanded. They did not know that Joseph understood, for the interpreter was between them, and he turned away from them, and he wept. At the top of his game, tears. There is an ocean of commentary on these tears. Here's Aviva Zonberg on this subject. Quote, this is the first of three occasions in which Joseph weeps. Each time he does so, something opens up in him, an unplanned response, which is at first a mere parenthesis as he turns away and back to his tyrannical role. I would say back to his theatrical role. In the course of that parenthesis, he knows himself lost and remembered by his brothers, and a new relationship is suggested, woven of regret, empathy, and loss. Tears in the Torah are of the utmost importance. God does not just laugh. Moshe Adel writes that weeping was a common Hasidic dream-inducing technique. Angels laugh. Angels cry, houses cry, our patriarchs cry, interestingly, more than our matriarchs cry. In biological terms, the tears are a marker of the human. In his book on Why Only Humans Weep, Ad Vanderhout writes, although crying has been documented in apes, elephants, and even camels, it seems that only humans produce emotional tears, and only humans cry. Crying behavior persists into adulthood. The challenge is to explain why this should be so, given that tears run the risk of signaling our presence to predators. In other words, what's the evolutionary value for a mammal to show signs of weakness in the form of tears? Tears are intellectual things, argues the scientist Thomas Dixon. They're produced both by thoughts and by glands. And the most recent research, which has a place in our Parsha, and in Zornberg's reading of Joseph, is that the evolutionary point of tears may be to evoke an empathetic response or the need for help by signaling it intimately, not with cries and shouts that might attack a hostile predator, but with silence, with the amidah. Well, I answered that last part. But the intimate tears remain. I am struck by the timing of Joseph's tears because they fall while his brothers argue over something that feels so important in this parsha. Are we the cause of things or the result of them? It's what makes all religions problematic, not just that bad things happen to good people, but that good things happen to bad people. I mean, if we really believe God answered our tears, our insincere tears, we'd all be sitting here with an onion and a lottery ticket. Yet by turning away and weeping, especially at this moment, doesn't Joseph repudiate the possibility of tyranny? Does it not show that our Jewish hero has no stomach for being the man God and the arbiter of life and death? When a child is unhappy, we say they are acting out. It's usually negative, to name a behavior meant to be stopped. But we shouldn't rush to judgment without recognizing that the reason for acting out is because often there's no other way to explain a complicated pain. Joseph may return to his theater of cruelty, hiding behind the curtain, believing he can control all the actions. But we know he won't end up there because he begins by placing himself above camels. He cries like a man. Here's the great poet Yehuda Amichai. In Jerusalem, tears do not weaken the eyes. They only polish and shine the hardness of the face like stone. I always thought that was a tough vision of tough Israeli Jews, but now I'm not so sure. A stone, sure, but it's a stone that shines, that reflects and illuminates our helplessness, our candles in the season of dreams. It's against nihilism. It's a rock that's a mirror. Shabbat shalom.